Yes.
Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is November the 15th, 2021, and I am continuing my weekly For Good and Evil podcast with Jimmy Sexton, who tells me that he's back in Dubai this week. And Jimmy Sexton is the CEO and founder of the Esquire Group. And for those who are joining just today, Jimmy and I, we are both fans of Charles W. Adams and his great book. It is a great book, Good and Evil. And Mr. Adams leaves us with 27 lessons of taxation, demonstrating the relationship between civilization and taxation. And to put it another way, as goes taxation, so goes civilizations. And this is lesson number 4. Welcome, Jimmy. How are you today?
I'm fantastic, John. It's good to be back and looking forward to today's podcast. I think it's really timely given this Washington Post article that you shared with me and what's going on in the U.S. So I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah, well, I took one look at this last night before going to bed, this lesson number 4, and thought, oh my God, how are we going to organize this one today? But I'm confident that we will persevere and add some interesting discussion to it. Well, let's start with lesson number 4, and I'm going to read this in for everybody. The ancient Greeks produced the first civilization without despotism. They achieved this by discovering that tyranny is the product of the wrong kind of taxation, especially direct taxation. Well, I think that we can probably agree that tyranny is definitely the product of the wrong kind of taxation.
Yep.
And I would say we've got a fair bit of that going on today.
Yes, we do.
But he singles out direct taxation as very much the wrong kind of taxation. And his title, For Good and Evil, I assume that he would regard direct taxation as evil taxation.
I certainly do.
Let's begin recognizing that there's no clear definition of what a lot of these things are. But in a general sense, what I think the difference between direct taxation and indirect taxation is something like this, and I welcome your comments. Direct taxation is just imposing a tax because something is, a poll tax, for example, or, oh my God, look, I see a piece of land, I think I'll tax it. Nothing happening. You're just a living, breathing, interesting person. The land is just sitting there. Indirect taxation, on the other hand, is taxation that results from some kind of an activity, something you did with the land, for example, something you bought, something you sold. They can't tax you because you exist, but they can tax income that you make. Does that seem to you to be at least a reasonable starting point?
Yeah, I think that's a very reasonable starting point. I think also from a logical standpoint, the fact that you wouldn't want direct taxation is very important, because with direct taxation, it is essentially a taking, right? It's a confiscation of your property. If it's just taxing something that exists because you have it, they're taking your property without you having done anything. And so I think that the taxation of income certainly makes a lot more sense. You're kind of taxing an intangible rather than taxing a tangible, which is an unreasonable taking, in my opinion. And that is also protected by the Constitution, or at least it's supposed to be.
Well, could we say this? All forms of direct taxation are evil, and some forms of indirect taxation are evil?
I would agree. And I would go so far as to say that, the Constitution, I'm not remembering con law really well right now. But I would say that the founding fathers of the United States, the sort of direct taxation was of prime concern, right? I mean, we sort of have two things in the Constitution that deal with it, right? No direct taxes and no unreasonable searches and seizures, right?
Now, that's interesting, because the unreasonable search and seizure, you know, we've talked before about the, you know, the inventory of things, right? The categorizing of things, right? So that's aimed at the, you know, sort of the information gathering component. Now, it is interesting to me that the founding fathers, and this is aimed at those who believe the Constitution should govern everything, you know, we're very much aware of direct taxation and very much saw the evil in it. And I'm wondering, I believe that you've got the text of the Constitution there in front of you. Would you be able to read in what the Constitution says about this?
Yeah, it says, no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken.
All right, definitely a mouthful, definitely a mouthful. But at a minimum, and I think, you know, borrowing from the article that we looked at today, at a minimum, that would mean that to the extent that direct taxation is allowed at all, it has to be based on proportionality, right?
Yeah.
And if we look at the idea of the billionaire's tax, and, you know, to give a shout out here, I'm looking at an article in the Washington Post written by Daniel Hamel, H-E-M-E-L, who's a law professor at the University of Chicago. The example that he uses as well, here's what he says. In other words, if a tax is a direct tax and 1.5% of the U.S. population lives in Alabama, then 1.5% of the revenue from the tax needs to come from Alabama. If the billionaire tax is deemed to be a direct tax, then the apportionment requirement would be impossible to satisfy. My God, you know what we're going to do? What the federal government will probably do is forcibly transport billionaires to new states, right?
Right. What they'll do is they'll just imprison them all, right? So they can't even
escape.
They're in the state in which they're resident.
You know, as we've talked about before, all of this is entirely academic, because the truth is the Internal Revenue Code has replaced the Constitution as the Constitution.
Yeah.
But in any case, so there's obviously a huge presumption, at least constitutionally, against direct taxes in the United States. You know, I remember in the 80s, Margaret Thatcher was actually proposing a poll tax in the UK. And that would be a clear example, I think, of a direct tax, at least in the United States. So I guess the good news is that Americans can say that they're protected against a poll tax, at least federally.
Yeah.
That may not be true in other countries. Okay, so sort of chronicling the history of this. I mean, the history of America really is a history of taxation, I think, isn't it?
I mean, it's why one of the main reasons America exists, right? People were trying to escape taxation. And it's very ironic where we're at now.
Exactly. It makes one. I mean, do you think the historians 1,000 years ago would write the history of the American Revolution as a group of so-called American patriots fighting a war against the British because they thought they should be taxed higher and they really wanted to create a more comprehensive, more punitive, and more perfect system of taxation? I mean, do you think that's what it was really about?
Oh, my God. I think if the founding fathers could see what's going on with U.S. taxes now, they would be turning in their grave. I mean, I think in reading the Constitution, you know, there's such protections against direct taxation and unreasonable searches and seizures. You can tell that the founding fathers were very much concerned with people taking their stuff. And now Congress is doing everything that they can to try to take people's stuff, or at least a portion of the value of their stuff.
Well, it's almost as if, you know, the way I see it is this, it's almost as though it's a presumption reversal, right? I mean, one could read the Constitution as saying, well, you know, there's a constitutional guarantee against search and seizure, right? There's a constitutional guarantee against your stuff being taken through direct taxation.
Yeah.
You know, you could look at it that way as the starting point. I don't think that that's how people actually read the Constitution. I think that what they think the Constitution means. I think that the way governments work, the U.S. government, and I think, you know, in fairness, most governments work on the theory that the presumption is that they can take anything they want, unless there's some specific thing in the Constitution that disallows them taking some specific thing, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think in general, with regulation and legislation, that governments are not all too concerned with constitutions and laws, right? I think they figure out what they want to do, and then they say, oh, you know, how does the Constitution perhaps impact what we want to do and how do we get around it? I mean, I don't think that anybody in Washington is reading the Constitution as, you know, sort of the guiding principles of the United States. I think they look at it as a nuisance. It's keeping them from doing what they want to do.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, we talk about these people who make these tax laws. I mean, they certainly don't read it. I don't even think they understand the Internal Revenue Code. I mean, last night I was reading, you know, the very last part of the Adams book, you know, where he says, well, really, you know, basically, you know, he was implying that the Congress, these basic legislators, shouldn't even be allowed to make tax laws.
Yeah.
And I think there's a great deal of truth in that.
I mean, look, I would argue that most of the people in Congress shouldn't be able to make any kind of laws because none of them understand what the hell they're doing, right? I mean, if you're going to have environmental laws, there should be environmentalists making those laws. There should be tax experts making tax laws. I mean, I know that they have these subcommittees and everything else, but they're hardly driven by expertise. And
well,
I think
they're also highly partisan.
Yeah.
You know, I was very, very interested in the Senate Finance Committee hearings that started in March of 2021. And it was so clear to me that they did not choose the witnesses to learn anything from the witnesses. They chose the witnesses because they knew in advance that he counted them to say this or that. I mean, there was this extraordinary one on hearing on the wealth tax, and the first witness that that was called was some billionaire who said, "Well, yes, I believe a wealth tax is okay." I mean, what? Good God! I mean, how is that a witness? I mean, is just, you know, somebody who agrees with your position and that. But you know, we ought to do a podcast someday on, you know, who should be making laws and what should be the process for making laws, because so much of this is way out of control. But back to the history of the United States. So in 1895, we have this case, Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust Company. And this apparently was the case that actually indirectly gave rise to the 13th Amendment, I think, the income tax, where what happens is that the Supreme Court said that, hey, you know, the prohibition against the direct tax is real, it matters, and that, hey, it even includes taxes on direct tax on personal property, et cetera. So, you know, this was a real setback to those who love taxation, eventually brought us into the 13th Amendment. And of course, we still have the 16th Amendment. And I suppose that the gift and estate tax regime is not a direct tax because something happens. You make a gift or you die or something.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, there was some sort of a realization event.
Something happened. Okay. Now, what I think might be interesting here would be to talk about this issue of direct tax versus indirect tax, which I suppose, direct tax versus indirect tax. And then I guess the next question is, well, if it's an indirect tax, does that automatically make it an income tax? You know, because of the problem of the realization event, right? For example, the transition tax has been challenged, or at least there was a very interesting article written by, I think, somebody named Sean McElroy a while ago, suggesting that because there was no realization event in the case of the transition tax, it was really a tax on wealth. Okay, it was really a tax on wealth. And because it was a tax on wealth, it could survive as a direct tax only if it was apportioned, et cetera, and therefore the transition tax had to be struck. In other words, exactly the same argument that we would expect to be heard in relation to this wealth tax. So one, let's look at the wealth tax. If we look at the wealth tax, it has to be, if it's a direct tax, it has to be fairly apportioned. It's not apportioned, so it would not be constitutional, correct?
Correct. But I would add one thing. When we look at the constitutional argument based on the, you know, that they're basing the wealth tax on, so that, you know, direct tax, the wealth tax being a direct tax, and also the argument that the deemed repatriation tax was a direct tax, I think it's a little bit different in my view. And the reason being is this: the proposed wealth tax is a tax, you know, essentially based on value or the increase in value of something, right? Like there was no realization event, there was no sale, there's nothing that happened.
Anywhere,
right? And when we look at it in the context of the transition tax, the transition tax was in no way based on the value of the shares owned by the U.S. taxpayer. It was based on a look-through basis of earnings of foreign corporations owned by the U.S. shareholder, right, of CFCs overseas. So it was based on the income that was generated by these foreign companies rather than the value of the shares. And so I think what it did is it attributed the income to the U.S. shareholder, but not necessarily based on value, but on the amount of income.
Right. Okay. You know, I think that's a very, very interesting point that you make here. And I'd like to just try to summarize that. And to do that, we're comparing the transition tax versus the recently proposed wealth tax, which was not actually a tax on the wealth, but a tax on a deemed gain, a pretend gain, if you will. Okay. But so one could look at that and say, well, you know, there was no realization event that would justify that type of thing. You're saying in the case of the reason why, which we call wealth tax, okay, but was really a deemed realization event. Well, there was no realization event anywhere.
Right.
But compare that to the transition tax, the CFC did have a realization event, so it was income within the CFC. So it was not a case of taxation without a realization event. It was a case of attributing the realization event of the corporation to the individual. And, you know, I think that's a very, very interesting and good point that you make. You know, whether it should change the legal outcome of it, I don't know, but it is, I think, a very, very significant point.
And I also think that, I think Democrats realize that they have a big direct taxation problem with the wealth tax and that it would be unconstitutional. And that's why I think they converted this billionaires tax thing into a sort of mark-to-market tax, because I think it's easier for them to argue that, hey, this is not a direct tax and that it gives them at least an in where they can argue that an unrealized gain is income, right? That's essentially what they're going to argue.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. So, you know, although all these articles talk about this being a wealth tax, the Wyden thing, I think, arguably is not a wealth tax for exactly the reasons that you're giving. But the Elizabeth Warren proposal from last March, right, where I think that was like 2% on the wealth, or something like this, whatever it was, no pretend real, it was not based on any pretend gain, nothing. That was just going after the value of the asset itself. And so that's why those two things are very, very different. And why, I mean, I think you're correct that the wealth tax in its purest form, as proposed by Elizabeth Warren, is much more likely to run into, you know, constitutional prohibition against the wealth tax. These other ones here, the transition, well, well, let's look at the expatriation tax, for example, right? I mean, that's one where, you know, there's a pretend gain. Yeah. And so the issue there is not whether it's a wealth tax, but whether it's an income tax in the sense there actually was income, right?
Yeah, and I think the only argument that I can find that would sort of say, okay, the expatriation tax is, let's say, valid, is because something happened, right? Like a minute ago, you had mentioned the estate tax or the gift tax. There was a triggering event, right? Either you died or you gave somebody something. There was a change. So with the expatriation tax, it's sort of the same thing, right? There's a change in your status from a U.S. person to a non-U.S. person. And I don't know what the legal argument would be to say that that's enough of a sort of change in circumstance or whatever to be a triggering event. But it seems like now what they're going to try to argue is, okay, becoming a billionaire is the triggering event, right? And does simply your level of wealth rise to that level? I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, very, very interesting. I mean, if we look at the expatriation tax, I mean, I take your point that something happened, you know, you expatriated, but nothing happened in relation to your assets that are being taxed, right? Nothing at all.
No.
So, I mean, the question, I think, you know, becomes, well, you know, where does one draw the line there?
Well, but, I mean, look, and I think that there's a potential, at least, you know, from a public policy perspective, there is a greater argument in favor of the expatriation tax, because you're taking those assets outside of the U.S. tax net, assuming they're not U.S. assets, right? So they're not going to be subject to estate tax anymore unless, of course, you know, they're going to U.S. persons or the U.S. assets. You can gift them freely. So I think from a public policy perspective, there's sort of an argument in favor of the exit tax, which is, hey, these assets are being taken outside of our taxing jurisdiction, most likely. And therefore, we're going to levy this exit tax to kind of make up for that, which from a public policy perspective makes sense. But from a billionaire standpoint, you don't have that, right? Like the assets are still staying in the US, everybody's staying American. The only thing that's happened is the level of wealth that somebody has.
Well, and of course, as we made the point, I think you would still agree that if I were a billionaire, you know, even the threat of this, I'd rather pay the 23.8% right now and just leave.
Oh,
rather than pay it once and then, you know, continue on. But this is interesting. As we bring this to an end,
Let me ask you a question. Do you think it's possible that if they pass this billionaire tax, because I thought about this, that if they pass this billionaire tax, that they put some type of really horrendous expatriation taxation in there that goes beyond what 877A is now?
Of course I do. Of course, yeah. I think it's possible. And not only that, but I think it might be likely. I mean, you know, if you, I don't know that we've ever talked about this, the two of us, but if you remember the proposed Warren wealth tax, I mean, there were, you know, horrendous, horrendous punishment, right?
It had an expatriation thing, right? Like if you left,
it did. So, I mean, it's not if there isn't, you know, precedent for the idea. Okay, let's, as we bring this to an end for today, it's been a very interesting discussion as always. Let's slowly go through some of these distinctions again, okay, for each of these, because, you know, it's very interesting how, as we talk about this, how, you know, these various examples really can be distinguished, right? So let's start off with the most blatant example of a direct tax. That would be what?
Well, I guess it would be a tax on land, right? I think that's
okay.
That's,
or a poll tax,
or
quite
tax.
Possibly the Warren wealth tax in its in its original configuration.
Agreed.
So now let's move down to the widen. I think we should call it a wealth tax, okay? The widen deemed gain tax on 700 billionaires. Let's call it that. So because it's not a direct tax on wealth, okay, but a tax on a pretend realization event, hard to argue that it's a direct tax, right?
Well, I still think they have a direct tax. I still think that they have a direct tax issue, right? Because if you're basing it solely that the triggering event is based on wealth, it would seem quite discriminatory to me. So I agree that it is not a wealth tax in the sense of, okay, your wealth is $100 billion, so we're going to take X percentage of it. It's based on a deemed gain. But it would seem to me that there still has to be some type of triggering event in order to trigger that gain. And I don't know if simply saying that somebody has a net worth of over $1 billion is going to pass muster for it not to be considered a direct tax.
Okay. All right. Good point. But at least conceptually, the way it's written, in terms of a pretend gain, even though nothing happened.
Yeah.
Now let's move to the transition tax. As I mentioned earlier, I have seen arguments to the effect that that's actually a direct tax. It's not an income tax. But you make a very good point here that, there may not have been income directly earned by the shareholder, but there was income earned by the controlled foreign corporation. So that's a question more of attribution, but certainly that distinguishes it from the Wyden thing, doesn't it?
It does. And I think that same point that I made about the transition tax kind of applies to all of these attribution regimes, let's call them, right? Which would be the repatriation tax, subpart F, GILTI, the throwback rules, PFIC. I think all these sort of, they're all income attribution rules, right, is what they are. So it's attributing income, but the receipt of that income was a realization event by someone. And that is then being attributed to the U.S. person. And it's based on income that was generated within a structure, let's say, rather than the mere market value of something.
Right. I wonder, with the PFIC and the throwback rules on these foreign trusts, I don't know that that's attribution, because in each case, there has to be an excess distribution. What's interesting about the PFIC that although there's an actual distribution, the way the tax is calculated is on a pretend basis by allocating it back in an equal way. Oh, my God. Well, it's clear that there are a number of distinctions among these different things, adding to the complications, which probably is a good reason to bring this to an end for today. But I think I would close by saying that, if nothing else, this discussion makes it clear there is no better place to add pure evil than in some kind of country's revenue code. Would you agree with that?
I would agree.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Until next week, then, where we'll be picking up, just to give a preview of what that one will be. Oh, look at this. Lesson 5. When wars or other great emergencies demand great revenues, then all citizens should be taxed according to what they are worth by equitable principles, not odious arbitrariness. Oh my God, giving us a week to think about that one.
It's going to be a good one.
All right. Well, thanks very much. I look forward to connecting with you next week.
Thanks, John.
Oh, Before we close, feel free to give out your coordinates.
Yeah, anybody interested in reaching me can do so at EsquireGroup.com or shoot us an email at info@EsquireGroup.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much.